So we're going to take a deep dive now into the text, and we're going to try and follow what I'm calling step one, which is this first section from Romans 9, 6 to 29. And this is a white knuckle ride. Yeah. So be prepared to be a little bit shocked, a little bit surprised, a little bit worried, anxious. Paul's going to take us on a dangerous journey. This is the passage that has been much discussed over the centuries. I'm talking right from the very beginning. Our earliest commentaries on Romans actually are from the 4th century. Ambrosiaster and John Chrysostom, Augustine, and they really struggled with this material. So the first question is, what is this passage about? And these older readings, Augustine onwards, famously Calvin, struggled with this passage because they said this is about predestination, and this is about the relationship between God's will and human will. And John Chrysostom, who was desperate to hold on to the freedom of the human will, was really worried by this text because it seemed to push in another direction. And Augustine, who wrestled with this text several times during his life, we have three versions of Augustine dealing with this text, and each time he comes back to it again and again. And he says, I can't make head or tail of this, but it seems to be about predestination, about the power of God's calling and election, even without our works, without our will. And I think the trouble with that debate is it gets wrapped into this as if this is a standalone theological topic, as if predestination is, as it were, the topic of this passage. Whereas I think it's about God's strange workings with Israel, which indeed there are. It's not about predestination as a standalone topic. It's about the story of Israel. Yes, Paul's commentary on the scriptures is full of comments about God's choice. And in particular, God's choice being irrespective of human worth. And we'll see how he expands and explores that in relation to the patriarchs. So, in a sense, it is talking about God's strange workings in history, but not as a standalone topic. He's trying to work out how Israel came to be. In newer readings, which have moved away from the older discussions about predestination, there's been the thesis that this is about God's way of redefining Israel. So it's been common, I won't get you into the details of this because I think this is not entirely right, but the argument has been, Paul is grappling with God's faithfulness to Israel, and he says, oh, it's all right. God has always, from the beginning, been about redefining who Israel is. So Israel just means those who believe in Christ. And if it's only a small number and a remnant, Paul is assuring himself that's okay. Well, the problem with that is I don't think Paul is discussing who is Israel, but he's discussing how Israel became Israel. So I don't think he's trying to tease out who qualifies for the label Israel. He's trying to tease out, he's going back to the beginning because he's trying to say there's something strange about the origins of Israel which sets the paradigm, sets the mark of God's dealings in history with Israel from the start. The problem with this reading that I've just described, a 20th century reading, is that it would undercut what he's just said about the privileges and the promises to Israel, the covenants and so on, if he were to say, well, it's only a few of Israel that really count as Israel. His grief, these are my kinsmen, those who don't believe. He's grieving about those who don't believe. He's not just saying, oh, it's fine, they don't count as Israel anymore. And if that reading, that 20th century reading, was right, then Paul would be spending his time here in chapter 9 saying, well, only some of Israel count as Israel. And then he changed his mind completely in chapter 11 when he says, hardening has come upon part, but so that all Israel will be saved. So I don't think it will work to take it the way that it's often been taken. But yes, it is the case that Paul is tracing a pattern in the story of the patriarchs. And that's what I want to explore with you. It's the pattern of how Israel came to be. You know, it's interesting, isn't it? Like, those stories in Genesis, we go back to those and they seem to us like somewhat strange stories that, you know, what's Abraham doing, going down to Egypt and passing off his wife as his sister? And it's like, who is this Abraham guy? And we have, you know, Sarah saying, well, I can't bear a child, so you have a child with Hagar, and he has a child with Hagar, Ishmael, and then God says, well, that's not your heir. That's not who I have. And then we have Hagar being sent off. Sarah gets peeved with Hagar because Hagar's saying, I have a child, you don't. And Sarah says, off you go into the desert. And then we have this story, fascinating story of Hagar, and God looks out for Hagar after all. And we read those stories and think, this is a weird bunch of stories. And I don't know what to do with them. There's an interesting new book, actually. Just anybody heard, slight digression here, anybody heard of the American novelist called Marilyn Robinson? Wrote a wonderful book called Gilead. I don't know if you've heard. She's written a book recently called Reading Genesis. And if you want to sort of have another go at reading those stories, I recommend that book. Anyway, these are strange stories. But all people, all Jewish interpreters of the Bible, Paul included, go back to these stories and saying, what is the secret here? What's going on? What's happening here? Why is God apparently working in such strange ways? And that's what Paul is trying to do here. So here's my thesis, that Paul is tracing the very foundations of Israel in order to show that Israel's very existence depends on the incongruous mercy of God. Incongruous meaning there's no match. It's not what you expect. It's not the people you would imagine. It's as if he's saying, you know, when you go back to these strange stories, they're strange precisely because they're meant to bring out the fact that Israel dangles, as it were, by a single thread. And the single thread is the mercy of God. There's nothing else that brings Israel into existence. There's nothing else that sustains Israel in existence except for the strange, mysterious, but wonderful mercy of God. In the course of this, he's going to raise the question, he does raise the question, whether God's mercy is just. And this is where it gets white knuckle, yeah? This is where it gets scary. Because for us, like, well, it must be just too, yeah? And Paul, as we'll see, twice raises the question, is there injustice with God? And we're going to talk about what's the relationship between mercy and justice. And I'm going to give you a little quote from Marilyn Robinson to discuss in that context. And he raises the question, whether mercy is accompanied equally by hardening, what he calls hardening. That makes us feel very uncomfortable. And I think the purpose is, and this is my thesis, is to underscore, to bring out to the sharpest possible profile that everything here, we all depend on the mercy of God. So one of the things to look out for in these verses is the not but. It's not this but that. Not the children of the flesh, but the children of promise. So that it should not be by works, but by God's calling. So it is not the firstborn, but God's choice. So these not but comments that come right through this, these are Paul's comments on the scripture where he's trying to put aside one way of reading the text, or one way that might be like what you would expect, and then highlighting, it's as if he's putting a highlighter on this. Look what's actually going on in this text. It's not what you might think, or it's not what is straightforward. So let's look at the patriarchs first. And we've already had a discussion of the patriarchs, haven't we, in Romans 4. Because we had that fascinating long discussion about Abraham. I'm not going to ask you, Alan, to summarize everything you did with Romans 4. But it's that fascinating text where Paul lights on that verse, Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him for righteousness. So who is this Abraham? Is he a righteous guy? No. Is he a guy that you'd admire? No. Is he a special guy from a special ancestry with a special privileges? No. What's special about Abraham? Nothing special about Abraham except that he believed God, God's promises. So Abraham, as it were, threw himself in utter dependence on the promises of God. And if there's anything special about Abraham, it's only that he received those promises of God, but not because there was anything intrinsic about him. And that's what Paul is going to trace further now. When he says it's not possible that the word of God has failed, he then says, for not all descended from Israel are Israel. And that, I think, is not to say that God has always selected, as it were, and is selecting again now in the present. It's to say that God's unfailing word to Israel has never been dependent on human criteria. God's word to Israel has operated by God's calling and mercy alone. So if things look bad on the human side, that's no obstacle to God. Let's have a look at the text in a bit of detail. So we've already dealt with Abraham in Romans 4, so the question is, how do God's purposes for Israel continue? And Paul's thought long and hard about that story of Isaac and Ishmael. Ishmael was Abraham's child through his slave maidservant, Hagar. And because Sarah couldn't have children, it looked like that's the only way in which God's amazing promises to Abraham would come about. God had promised, you will have this, you will be the ancestor for this huge nation. He said, look up at the sky, see how many stars there are there. And if you go out in the desert and look at the sky, there's a lot of stars up there. Yeah? That's how many your progeny will be. And Abraham says, but I don't have any children. How's this going to get going? And God said, it will be. And that's what Abraham believed. The promise of God out of nothing. When all the human signs said no, God said yes. Yeah? And that's what Paul says in Romans 4, Abraham, who believed in the God who brings life out of death and calls into being the things that are nothing. So this creative God who can turn the impossible into the possible. So Paul says, okay, so let's look at this Isaac and Ishmael story, because God made a promise through Sarah, shall your offspring be called, and Sarah was barren. As Paul says in Romans 4, her womb was as good as dead. And Abraham was an old man, far beyond being able to father children. But the promise was the promise. Israel's privileges are the promises. And what Paul is pointing out, let me just read the text here. It's not as though the word of God has failed, for not all Israelites truly belong to Israel. Not all of Abraham's children are his true descendants. But, and here he quotes, it's through Isaac that descendants shall be named after you. This means, and here's Paul's comment on the text, it's not, here's first not but, it's not the children of the flesh who are the children of God, but the children of the promise are counted as descendants. Now you might say both of the children are children of the flesh, but the point is it's not the flesh alone that determines. You might say, well, Ishmael is Abraham's child, so that's the way the descent will go. God ensured that the promise would carry on from Abraham through this miraculous way, the child of the promise, not the child of the flesh, not just the natural born child. So there's something about the very foundation of Israel here, which is about God working in a way that confounds your expectations. Children, I know what children are, they're biological children. Oh, but God's definition of a child is more than just biological child, it's a child of the promise. The very fact that Isaac is born is a fact of God creating something out of nothing. Israel is born, as it were, it comes to be out of that extraordinary action of the promise. This is what the promise said: about this time I'll return and Sarah shall have a son. And indeed, that's what happened. So Paul said, well, what about the next generation? All right, Isaac marries Rebecca. And something weird goes on in the next generation too. In the first generation, it'll be Isaac, not Ishmael. In the second generation, there's twins. And you might expect, because of the ancient rule of primogeniture, that always the firstborn is the one who's the heir, you might expect, well, the first one to come out is going to be the one, yeah? Esau is born first. So the normal rule would be, okay, so Esau is the one through whom the line will continue. But actually, it's Jacob, the next one. What? Why is that? But Paul notices something even stranger. Before they were born, God said, it'll be Jacob. It'll be the younger. It'll be the older who serves the younger. It'll be the younger one. And Paul is not the first, because we know one of his contemporaries, Philo, the Jewish philosopher from Alexandria, also puzzled over this, said, how would God decide it would be Jacob and not Esau? And Philo says, this looks arbitrary. And God's not arbitrary. So God must have known that Jacob would be a good man and that Esau would be a bad man. And God must have known that's why the line would be through Jacob, because Jacob was a more worthy recipient of the promises and the grace of God. Now, if you read the story, it's not obvious that Jacob is a good man, yeah? Yeah? He's not your paragon of virtue, is he? He's a bit of a trickster. And he deceives his father into receiving the blessing, and he tricks Esau out of his firstborn status, and so on. So I think Paul's conscious of that. That doesn't quite work. But what interests Paul, and what worried Philo, but what interests Paul is, you know, God made that decision before they were born. Before, and this is what I'm reading in the text now, even before they'd been born and done anything good or bad, so that God's purpose of election might continue. Here's Paul's commentary. Not by works, but by his call. She, Rebecca, was told, the elder shall serve the younger. So, in the first generation, you might expect, well, it's going to be Ishmael because he's Abraham's child and he's the firstborn. No, it's not going to be Ishmael. It's going to be Isaac, the child of the promise. And in the second generation, you might think, well, it's going to be Esau because he's the first out of the womb. Or if God chooses Jacob, it must be because he's done something good. And Paul says, no, before they were even born. And it's like Paul has taken away every kind of criterion of worth or that you would expect. Birth, status, that's who's the firstborn. Practice, that's works, behavior, character. All of those are criteria of worth by which one might expect God to choose. Yeah? Because that's what we expect God to do, to select those who are on some criterion or other superior and worthy of his grace. That would make God, we would say, a just God. And Paul's spent these first few verses undercutting that presumption. Yeah, it's like really unsettling us and saying, you know what? It wasn't what you think. It wasn't how you would choose. It's God working in his way. And the only thing you can say, why Jacob and not Esau? God chose it that way. Whoa, that's scary. Yeah? That's going over the top of our roller coaster. Yeah? Israel is not a nation singled out because of its worth. Israel exists from the very beginning only by God's choice alone. And Paul drilling down into that. I've seen that exactly in those early stories of Israel, those early stories of how Israel came to be. It's as if the very character built into the DNA, as it were, of Israel from the beginning is, you know, it only exists because of God's mercy or choice. Now, he then takes us on into the next generation, and this is where the steep decline, as it were, as on our roller coaster, we're going to go even steeper now, yeah? It takes us to the Exodus story. Because there is a kind of sequence through this chapter of sort of, he's taking us from the patriarchs to the Exodus, and then we're going to end up with some statements by the prophets relating to the exile. So there's a kind of historical sequence here, like all the way through Israel's past. Now, the Exodus. What then are we to say? Is there any injustice on God's part? Because he's kind of like, well, what you think is just here, like, well, the righteous get rewarded and the bad people don't. He said, that's not going on here. What, is there injustice in God's part? By no means. Why then did God choose Moses? Why did he choose Israel? And Paul goes back to that golden calf story in Exodus 32 to 34. And when Moses is pleading with God, And God issues this extraordinary comment: I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. As if Paul's kind of like, what? And drills into that a bit. What is that? How do you read it? Is it encouraging? Or is it unnerving? It's kind of a bit of both, isn't it? It's like, oh, okay. God can have compassion even on the faithless Israel. Because this is said in a context of disaster and faithlessness. But note that future, that means you can't see it yet. And note it, I. Yeah? I will have compassion on whom I have. This is God saying, you know, it's not up to you, it's up to me. And you're thinking as you go over that top, like, whoa. I thought I could predict, I thought I could determine, I thought I could clarify, I thought I could explain. Now I'm not sure I can anymore. It's going to get a bit harder now, all right? We've gone down over the top, and then we're going to go into a tunnel, all right? We're on a roller coaster. We've gone down a mighty steep slope. We're about to go into a very dark tunnel. Because Paul says, okay, so God had mercy on Israel. Yeah, fine, but what about Pharaoh? And you know, the stories about Pharaoh are very interesting, because sometimes they talk about God hardening Pharaoh's heart, and sometimes they say Pharaoh hardened his heart. So some of the stories themselves in the Exodus sometimes seem to say this is God's work, and sometimes they seem to say it's Pharaoh's work. And you might say, okay, so that raises this fascinating question of how our wills relate to God's will. But Paul's quite one-sided here. He doesn't say, well, Pharaoh made a massive mistake here. Pharaoh was completely out of touch with God's will, and Pharaoh cruelly and wrongly tried to keep Israel. He takes us into this, as I say, it's dark in here, yeah? This tunnel where he says, you know, God said to Pharaoh, I've raised you up for the very purpose of showing my power in you so that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. So then he has mercy. Whoa, this is scary. He has mercy on whomever he chooses, and he hardens the heart of whomever he chooses. So if this is God's choice both ways, have we arrived at double predestination? Do you know what I mean by that? God predestined some for salvation, God predestined some for what used to be called damnation. That's what Calvin grappled. If any of you have read Calvin's Institutes, you'll know he was pressed more and more and more. He produced the Institutes in several different editions, and this bit on predestination kept growing and growing and growing because people kept pressing him on this. He said, I don't really want to talk about it, but... And he ended up with a kind of double predestination, yeah, which is scary. Not quite. I think not quite, because we look like that's the tunnel which has no exit. Interestingly, when Paul talks about it, he uses the image of the clay and the potter, and he says, we'll come back to this, the clay can't answer back to the potter. He says, has the potter no right over the clay to make out of the same lump one object for special use and another for ordinary use? What if God, desiring to show his wrath and to make known his power, has endured with much patience the objects of wrath that are made for destruction. What if he's done so in order to make known the riches of his glory for the objects of mercy, which is prepared beforehand for glory? So the image we have is, well, the potter makes two kinds of pots. Some of these are going to be ordinary, some of these are going to be special. And what if God has prepared certain pots for glory and others for destruction? And you think, whoa, we've got this double predestination of the potter. But note, not quite, because you never hear those pots shatter. Yeah? He says, what if God has endured? And that's a word, the word he uses, and it echoes what he said back in chapter 2. You know the mercy and the endurance, the patience of God. It's as if these pots that you think you're about to hear the potter say, right, that's enough of those. Let's throw them in the bin, melt them, heat them up again, make. It says, what if God has endured these? There's something in the mercy of God here that seems to be determining a future, but is holding things. Holding things that look like they're nothing but disaster, but has a long-term prospect. God's strange workings that seem to be heading in one direction, but what looks negative may be God holding something. God's got a grip of it, and he's holding it for the future. The emphasis, I think, here is not on two different fates. The emphasis is on God's purpose, God's long-term purpose, God's goal to make known the riches of his glory for the objects of mercy. And just when you think, well, there are two objects, there's objects of mercy and objects of destruction, Paul unsettles you at that point and talks by talking about endurance. You think, what if the objects for destruction could themselves become the objects of mercy? Is that possible? Is that possible that he has endured, kept, sustained in order that in time they too might become objects of mercy? Because that's where we're going to go to as these chapters progress. And there's just a sign here, I think, that it isn't as settled and as determined and as finished as you might think. So we've gone into this tunnel, and which looks like things are determined, but there's a little bit of light at the end of that tunnel. Yeah? There's something glimmering at the end to say, God is greater than you think. You know, if the moment you think you know what God's plan is, hold back a minute. Yeah, the moment you think, I've got it, I've got God now, I've got the secret, I know what this is about. There's two types of people, and God's loved some and he's not loved others. Paul points you to the end and says, you know, you don't quite know God yet. I'll have mercy on whom I have mercy. It's not your choice. What if God is just holding out for the moment? What if there's a future that you don't expect? But the question that then revolves through this is, well, if God has mercy in these ways and God acts in these ways, is God unjust? And twice in these verses, Paul raises this question, and it really bothers him. Is God being arbitrary? Is God's mercy unjust in some way? Because if it's the case that he's chosen one and not another, but without regard to their works, without regard to their merit, their character, and so on, does God not care about justice? These are the hard questions of verse 14, what are we to say? Is that injustice on God's part? Or in verse 19, well, you'll say to me, if God has mercy and God hardens, why is he still finding fault? Who can resist his will? And Paul at first seems to kind of bat that away. Who are you, the clay, to talk to the potter? Like, you can't raise questions about God's injustice. You're not the person in charge here. But I think he's grappling with a very deep, I told you we were going to get into deep water here, yeah? A very deep theological question, like, how are we to understand the justice of God? Is he just batting this away, the clay can't answer the potter? Or is there a sense that if mercy is incongruous, if mercy works in without regard to our human standards of worth and status and significance and merit, is there some sense in which this is not going to fit our notions of justice? If God has mercy on the undeserving, what does that do to our sense of God's justice? Because we would expect a just God to say, I'll pick the righteous ones and I'll not pick the unrighteous ones. But God never worked that way in the first generations and is not working that way now either, says Paul. There's a fascinating, I want to give you this quote from this book by Marilyn Robinson called Gilead, and a few of you have read it. I want you to discuss this. And it's a comment about love, but it's because she's talking about divine love. There's no justice in love, no proportion in it, and there need not be. Because in any specific instance, it, human love, is only a glimpse or a parable of an embracing, incomprehensible reality. It makes no sense at all because it is the eternal breaking in on the temporal. Do you see what she's saying? There's something about the operations, even of human love, but which is only just an echo, as it were, of divine love, which goes beyond our notions of what's proportional or just. And the reason it goes beyond is because our own calculations of what is a proper cause or what's a proper consequence of things, our own calculations of how justice should work, is not going to be adequate to understand something breaking into our world from outside. Yeah? So it's as if, like, every time you think we've got God sorted, we have to say, and whose criteria am I using here for sorting out God? I want you to discuss that with your neighbor. Like, whoa, what is that about? Does justice and mercy, is mercy always beyond justice? Is mercy compatible with justice? Do you see what the question I'm asking? Like, is love, because it is an echo of divine love, is it always going to exceed? So that the question's like, is there justice before God? Is a question like, well, yes, there is, but maybe not in the terms I would define it. Have a little word with your neighbor about that, just to chew over that for a minute or two. So I warned you, didn't I? I throw you into the deep water here. Anybody got any comments on this? What do you make of this?
Yeah, as you've been talking, there were two bits of scripture I was reflecting on, but there's with Paul looking back to the patriarchs, I wondered how much he was thinking of that moment where Abraham is wrestling with God or with the three angels, whatever we understand that they are, kind of and reflecting on, do we wrestle with this? Is there an invitation there to say, yeah, we can't understand it, but there's value in the wrestling with it? And that sort of feels like what Paul is doing here.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think that's right. And actually, that's the very place where Abraham asks, will not the judge of all the earth be just, isn't it? Like, he's pleading for Sodom. And so there's that, deep in those patriarchal stories, is this question, like, is... Can we figure out what God is doing? Does it fit our, or does it break our notions of what looks just? And the, I think the point is that mercy always goes beyond justice. Maybe not against it, but always beyond it. You know, like, why should Sodom be saved? Well, there's only 10 there. You know, but God saves. You know, for their sake. For those sake, I'm not. And there's this sense of human notions of justice are always going to be too restrictive, too limited for what this God is able to do. Yeah, thank you. But thank you. Anybody got any other comments on it? Yeah, there's one here. Yeah.
In the last part of this presentation, I've been thinking a lot about Job and the book of Job, because this is another question that has been since the ages began. Yeah. You could even say that Satan, the adversary, when he tempted Eve, was saying, is God being just? In that question of, you know, hath God said, you know, behind it is that God's trying to hide something from you. Is God a God of justice? And I think we see that then in Job and through so many of the books. And the way you've seen that scarlet thread of mercy is quite incredible. I love the fact that the pots haven't been shattered. That's grace.
Yeah. I think, you know, this is one of those passages where it kind of almost doesn't allow you to say, okay, so now I've got a new theological position on this, as it were. It's almost like it's taking you to the point where you say, you know, this is, I don't quite know what's going on here, but I know that God has mercy on whom he has mercy. And that means every time I try and get this, as it were, settled into a box, I find God has escaped that box. Every time I make a theological, systematic, dogmatic judgment on this, I'm reminded that God is bigger than my judgment. And I think that's where Paul is taking us through this passage. That he takes us to the very edge, if you like, of heresy here. Almost like, what are you saying? God is arbitrary. It takes us to the very edge of even unbelief in order to say, yeah, so God is a lot bigger than you think. And a lot is going on in history that you don't understand. And a lot is going on in your life that you don't understand. And because God has purposes deeper than you can grapple with. Which is kind of scary, because I like to be in control, thank you very much. I like to reason, I like to know, I like to understand. I like to be able to give a clear, definite explanation for what God's about. And then you realize, actually, I'm talking about God here. And God is not comprehensible as the way you'd like God to be. That's frightening, a little bit frightening and a little bit assuring as well, isn't it? Because if God did work purely by justice, we wouldn't be here. Okay, any other quick comments on that? Yeah, one here, yeah. Yeah, and we'll move on.
A lot of people seem to want to draw a wedge between Paul and Jesus of the Gospels, but Jesus, when he preaches the parable of the workers in the vineyard, it grates with us. He says to Peter, you just called me the Messiah, but you obviously don't have in mind the things of God, only human concerns. And time again, it's like, James and John, you're calling down fire from heaven. You have no idea what spirit you have. And so it's very much consistent. The more we look at it, the closer they are, not the further apart.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's a very deep resonance here between the kind of incongruity, the mystery of God's grace here in Paul, and the way Jesus keeps saying, don't think you understand what's going on here. It's the Samaritan, it's the outsider, it's the one you don't expect. And the parable of the vineyard workers is a very good one. You know what justice should look like. God's mercy and God's grace is bigger than that. Yeah. So just to look at the last few things he says about the vessels of mercy in this passage, because he's talking about God's calling. He said, these vessels of mercy he's prepared beforehand for glory, including us, verse 24, whom he has called, not from the Jews only, but also from the Gentiles, as indeed he says in Hosea, those who are not my people, I'll call my people, and her who was not beloved, I will call beloved. And into the very place where it was said to them, you're not my people, they should be called children of the living God. Now, Hosea is an absolutely extraordinary prophet, and this is the passage where God says, Israel has gone so far astray that I'm going to cast them off. And yet, God then says, you know, those who I've just decided are not my people, I'm going to have mercy on them, and then call them my people. So Hosea is a prophet, and that's why Paul resonates with him, a prophet who's grappled with some of these same questions, like what is God's purposes for Israel? Has Israel's story come to an end? He says, you know, God can look and say, that's the one that's not loved, but you know, it is now beloved. I'm going to have mercy on the unloved, on the unlovely. So Hosea is one of those, and this passage in Hosea is one of those texts where God reveals himself as a God who's continually moving beyond where you think things have got to, and moving beyond in a spirit of mercy and grace. And so Paul says, you know, this is happening now because the people he's calling are Gentiles as well as Jews. And he's giving us a glimpse here of what he's going to say in the next step, which is the fact that something weird is happening now, that God's mercy on his people has extended also to his non-people. And he uses the word calling here. It's a very important word in Paul's theology. You remember I quoted from Romans 4 there earlier, the God who calls into being the things that don't exist, who raises the dead and calls into being the things that don't exist. Calling is not just an invitation. It's like the calling, it's like God says, let there be light. That's a calling, yeah? It's a calling into being. It's a creative word that says, this will be. You know, we use the word conversion a lot. You know, when did you convert? And Paul would say, when were you called? Interesting, isn't it? When were you called? Not when did you take a step, but when did God call you? And calling meaning more than just an invitation. Hey, you there over there. But a calling into being, a creative word. And God's calling is this action, voice and action, because God's words have effects. God's voice and action creating something new. And here verses from Hosea 2 are taken to refer to Gentiles and therefore to anyone not loved. So you see how instead of coming to a kind of ultra-Calvinist fixed decree, there are some people who are just damned from the beginning, and it's too bad, but that's the way it is. And there are other people who are loved and called, and that's how it is. That's where a kind of Calvinist logic gets you to, this double predestination, like it's just all fixed from eternity and now what you can do about it. Instead of that, Paul has this sense that those who are not loved could be loved. Those who are hardened could be unhardened. Those who are not called can be called. There's a kind of fluidity here, a kind of possibility opening up. Like as I say, he's taken us into that tunnel, but there's a little bit of light at the end of that tunnel because there seems to be this always this chance that God's creative mercy can have an effect. One of the people who influenced me a lot a while back was a man called Lou Martin, a great New Testament scholar, and he we talked about our families, and he said one of his oldest son, who is an academic in another field in Germany, who had lost his faith or never really come to faith. And Lou obviously thought long and hard about this. He was a great theologian, but his comment was always, God's grace will get him in the end. And I thought that was really profound thing to say, but also a very kind of open-ended thing. Like, my dear son, I don't know what God is doing, but God's grace will get him in the end. It's not like, and he will change his mind in the end, but God's grace will get him in the end. Yeah? You see the difference in there. Who's going to take the initiative here? But this sort of confidence that I don't know how, I don't know when, I don't know under what circumstances, but God's grace has not let go of him. And there's something about that spirit, I think, here. And it's like those who are not loved, God has, in the very place where it said to them, you're not my people, there they shall be called children of the living God. And at the end of these verses, Paul talks about Israel being reduced to a remnant. And you might say, well, then that's it then, isn't it? There's the rest, and too bad for them, but at least there's a remnant. But the point about a remnant, and here this is a very clear theme in the Hebrew scriptures, the point about a remnant is the remnant is a sign of hope, not a sign of despair. There's a stump left. Reminds me of the sycamore tree, sycamore gap, you know, that was cut down, like, oh, there's some other trees coming out of that. There's not an end to the, this is not an end to the story. There's something that can come out of it. So here we are, these conclusions. Are these verses deliberately unnerving, deliberately destabilizing? I think they are. I think, as I say, they're meant to take you over that edge until you realize, like, it's not me in control here. Israel's very story is constituted by mercy. So who can set limits on how God acts? And who can set limits on who is called? This story of this people, and as I say, this matters to us because this is our DNA too. This is who we are. This is what we've been grafted into. This is what we've been joined to. We're the outsider. We've been joined to this story. So it's important to know how this story works, yeah? If we don't see what the pattern is, we're going to get the wrong idea here. So when we understand, as it were, where we have come from or what we've been joined to, we see we're in the hands of a God who has mercy on whom he has mercy. That's the only reason we're in there. Yeah? It's the only reason Israel got to be Israel. And that means the future is in God's hands. Israel's very existence from the start has been dependent on the mercy of God. Its past, its present, and its future are in the hands of God alone. So that's what we're going to trace through in the next sessions. But that's where I think we've got to in this session so far.